and welcome to The Sound of Economics, podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. I am Maria Demergis, Bruegel's deputy director, and today I'm hosting the director's cut of The Sound of Economics podcast. Joining me for a conversation about the current state of macroeconomics is Professor Nicola Viegi, South African Reserve Bank Professor of Monetary Economics at the University of Pretoria. Hello, Nicola.
Thank you. Hello. Hi, Maria.
And Frank Smets, Director General of Economics at the European Central Bank. Hello, Frank.
Hi, Maria.
Thank you both for joining me for a topic that is actually very special. There has been a lot of discussions on this issue, and I thought that you are two very suitable people to have this conversation with. You both have experience with the academic part of macroeconomics, but you also have a lot of experience in the way that we use macroeconomics. And my questions to you, if I may start, would be, what did macroeconomics do wrong and therefore miss to predict? What, in all senses of the word, has been the most severe crisis in our lifetime? And if I may start with you, Nicola, what did you think microeconomics has done wrong prior to the crisis, before we can even think about changing microeconomics?
Well, actually, I was reflecting a bit to this team when after receiving the invitation. And obviously, a simple answer would be that we never really consider or we never really internalize the development of the financial sector and the globalization of the financial market in our macro models. Therefore, we never really consider the imbalances that were coming in the financial market as a relevant issue for our macroeconomic model. The more I think about it, I mean, there is an element of, the defensiveness also in terms of what macroeconomics is. In the sense that macroeconomics has got this characteristic of being an engineering. It's an engineering that always deal with whatever problem it seems more important at that time. A lot of the development in macro are really a response to event when they are. For example, it's not that we didn't see the imbalances. It's that because these imbalances didn't seem to represent a significant effect on our inflation and output, we gave another explanation of the imbalance. Therefore, for example, if you consider European Union, when you had the imbalance of the current account, the discussion was that this imbalance are not a problem because it is an imbalance that can be justified by the difference in capital return in different countries.
Nicola, looking back, that looks pretty naive, right? I mean, the imbalances, you mentioned the current account imbalances. We were talking about severe current account imbalances in the euro area. And we just, simply because we didn't see it somewhere, as you say, we didn't see it in inflation, we didn't even see it in the exchange rate, we just ignore it as though it's a no relevant problem. But that's actually the problem, no?
No, you see, if you want, it's even worse. It's not that we didn't ignore it. We gave an explanation of why that happened. Okay. And therefore, we had a narrative that explained, in the context of the model we were using, why we had those imbalances. Mm. Therefore, that's why I'm saying, the economics, macroeconomics as an engineering, that really we react and we develop our model often as a response to a specific issue that we face. Therefore, it's like we model for the previous crisis.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's not that we were. In some sense, this one is also a characteristic of macro. It's the way macro was developed from the beginning. It was never developed by first principle. Therefore, almost by definition, cannot capture everything. And therefore, obviously, the crisis, represented a big indication that we need to develop our understanding of the relation between finance and macroeconomics. We need to have a better understanding of the role of capital flows. For example, being in South Africa, this one become the very, very important issue that we deal we need to model develop every day, that is how we deal with these big financial flows that also define a different kind of shocks that the economy.
But it's the case that macroeconomics is a lot about abstraction, right? If you're trying to attack a problem, you need to abstract in order to be able to understand it and analyze it. But the question is here is how we might abstract it to irrelevance. You know, I mean, I'm being provocative here. I don't necessarily mean that macro is irrelevant, but you know, if you're going to miss huge imbalances, if you're going to miss crisis of the sort that we've seen through abstraction, then obviously you might be doing something wrong. And if I may turn to you, Frank, you're one of the fathers of the big models that we use in standard macro. And you know, what's your view on this?
Well, I mean, first of all, of course, we can blame macroeconomics or macroeconomic theory or practice. But I mean, these models, they don't speak, no? It's really the economists that use the macro models that we should look at, and also the policymakers that use the macro models.
Sure.
And of course, when we look back, we were in a period which was called the Great Moderation. Mervyn King called it the nice period, the non-inflationary, continuously expanding period. That period was well explained by sort of the standard macro models at that time, which were the Keynesian models that I also worked on, and which to some extent had interacted a lot with sort of the inflation targeting, price stability oriented monetary policy regimes that were set up since the late 80s and the late 90s. In the meantime, and so everything looked nice, as Mervyn King said. Now, in the meantime, of course, these imbalances were developing. And I don't think it was not that we didn't see it. For example, Jean-Claude Trichet, who was at that time president of the ECB, he didn't miss any occasion to tell governments in the Eurozone that there were very important divergences in relative unit labor cost, in competitiveness, which needed to be addressed. But he thought that that needed to be addressed by governments and by other policies. And of course, the current account developments was part of that. Also, in the context of our monetary analysis, we did think and also did some research on sort of leaning against the wind and this type of policies before the crisis. Actually, I myself had a paper in 2004 where I talked about, called and wrote about costly asset price booms, which was very much in the spirit of the BIS work, showing that asset price booms that are go together with leverage and credit growth can be very costly. So why is it that this was not followed up upon, that this was not? And I think part of it is that we didn't have the tools. And I think there Nicolai is right. Our models, the standard models that we used, assumed more or less perfect arbitrage, perfectly working asset markets. And so it was very hard to analyze that type of issues in those baseline models. The other thing is that probably we underestimated generally the systemic implications of some of these booms turning into busts. I don't think anybody, there were people that predicted catastrophe, but there were very few that understood the contagion and the feedback effects that we actually saw between liquidity and solvency, between sovereigns and banks, like in the euro area. I don't think anybody had spoken about the doom loop as we did ex post. So part of it was that, yeah, we didn't understand the systemic implications and these transmission mechanisms. And that led, I think, to a certain complacency in the sense that we thought we could deal with it. And the third element that I would mention is that even if we did, it was also not clear that we had the tools. No, if I think of it again about the euro area, The imbalances were within euro area imbalances mostly. You know, the credit growth and the asset price, the real estate price booms were in certain parts of the euro area, basically in Ireland, in Spain, to some extent in Portugal. In Germany, in contrast, actually we had house price deflation. And so as a sort of a monetary policy maker, and I'm working at the central bank, of course it was not clear that, it was clear that the tool of monetary policy was difficult to use, because we have a single instrument for the whole euro area. At the same time, the whole area of macroprudential was not yet developed to the extent, I mean, there was some work going on, but in practice, this was only developed after the crisis with the G20 initiative and then also the European implementation of this. So there was also an issue of which tools would you use to address those imbalances.
If I may, Frank, you're talking about the tools. We like the tools, but importantly, we also like the understanding of certain things. I mean, you know, certainly the contagion effects in the global scale, not just the European scale, where you had a crisis that originated with a very small economic shock in the US, and that spread in ways that nobody could have ever predicted, simply because they're very, very non-linear. So there are both tools and our understanding of basically how the economy works in a very interdependent world. And of course, the question that begs itself to be asked is, you know, what happens next? How are we better prepared now as a science or as an art, macroeconomic art? And what tools do we have in our disposal to ensure that not only we do better in the future, but we also understand that our understanding is limited? Nicola, what's your view on this?
I think after the crisis, the field of macroeconomics and our understanding of how we should use models, I think has sharpened quite a lot.
Can you specify how? In which terms? How are modeling now a little bit different than?
In the sense that we are moving away from one model, and we are just developing much more an eclectic view of how we should use models. And how models interact with each other to try and to understand the peculiarity or the non-linearity that are in the economy. I think this element is actually is quite positive. Now, if you see a lot of the new research, the research is really try to, you know, explore the corners, explore the things that cannot be captured by a sort of forecasting model, looking from heterogeneous agent, heterogeneous firm, issue of finance, capital flows, or issue of moralized adverse selection, the issue of macroprudential policy. All these are really analyzed in a lot of different models that talk to each other. But at least we have abandoned a bit the idea that we need to build the model. Because the building of the model, by definition, the more complex the model is, more less robust the model is to any possible shock or possible change. And actually, I think is a very interesting time for the profession. The issue is, as always, you know, we build the tool, but we are not necessarily the user of the tool. I think this one is something that Simon Vrain-Lewis always stress. One thing is the research and the discussion here. One thing is the macroeconomics that is used out there.
Yeah.
If you want
the macroeconomics. Is that Frank?
Yes. No, sorry. I agree with Nicola. One of the positive outcomes of the crisis is that the groupthink, which I think was a little bit there in macro before the crisis, is gone. Now we have somebody said, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Now, in the in the practice of policy making, of course, it's never the case that one model sort of dominates. I mean, in the practice, there is actually lots of models. I mean, if I look at our last monetary policy meeting and the analysis that has been done and prepared, I mean, I can probably think of at least 20 models that have been used, from sort of the main macro models, but different variants of it. I mean, if you want to analyze the fiscal package in the US, you need a different model than if you want to analyze the possibility of spillovers from an increase in volatility, or you need a different model if you want to analyze why the term premium has fallen so much. So there's lots of models, and I think this has always been the case, but there was, and this is not sort of the physical model, but it's more the mental model. There was a groupthink, which basically was based on the basic New Keynesian model, which is still very much alive and very important in a number of dimensions, in the sense that what it showed, like the importance of inflation expectations, the importance of time consistent policy, the importance of price stickiness, is still there. But of course, it cannot show what it was not made for, and that's where all these other models play a role. Now, in policy, it is also important, right, to have sort of a language when you talk amongst economists. And so I don't think the solution is that we just have lots and lots of small models and do not try to actually kind of integrate again some of these new developments. I think synthesis is also very important in macroeconomic theory and practice. And I don't think we're there yet, but as Nicolas said, I mean, there's lots of, it's probably one of the most interesting times to be a macroeconomist. There's lots of research on, not only on incorporating finance in macro, but also on heterogeneity. Last week I was attending a seminar that was talking about the interaction between supply and demand through precautionary savings behavior, some of the work that Martin Vaughan and his colleagues are doing. All these things, I mean, introducing networks in macro, I think is very important.
If I may, there is, of course, a lot that can be done, and I'm very delighted that we're doing that, and because, I mean, you know, as you said, there isn't just the one model. We need more models to inform the discussion. But we are going in the direction of greater complexity as well, and the more complex we make things, the less usable we also make them. So one of the, and here, Nicola, you will appreciate this, one of the things that you know, I worry about is that, how about the things we don't know? How do we prepare for things that are not necessarily captured by our models? And in fact, you know, how do we prepare about their lack of knowledge? Because it doesn't really matter how many things you put into a model, there will always be things that you don't know. And you know, science is part of the job of science, to try and understand what we don't know. But, you know, it's a catch-up game. And therefore, some of the effort that we make is also about living with the unknown unknowns, if you like, Frank. And, you know, there I think the insistence of macroeconomics in trying to be very, very predictable, you know, the forecasting part of it, numbers are important, maybe takes away some effort that ought to be also dedicated in terms of how we manage the uncertainty. So if I may ask you to comment on this, because we are sort of coming short of time, and if I start with you, Nicola, what's your views on the unknown?
In working in emerging countries at this time, actually the unknowns are very, very many. Therefore, because, you know, there is the issue of the normative element of macroeconomics. We need all the research, but we need also the actual economic policy. And what we are experiencing now for our emerging countries is the nature of the shock we are facing are not predictable anymore. And also what kind of structure we are going to face in the future are not predictable anymore. Therefore, we come from an idea that if in emerging countries we get the institution right, if we have independent monetary policy, inflation targeting, long-term fiscal fiscal balance, etc., if we behave as the good guys, the world market will recognize it, will praise us, to arrive in a situation in which all the shocks are coming from the north. Therefore, all the shocks is the financial crisis, the European fiscal crisis, is the potential trade collapse, the kind of risk we are facing cannot be faced only by institutional adjustment, must be faced by really think about how you make a system robust or resilient. It's not even the policy itself. It's the ability of the system to adjust and react to the things when they happen. Therefore, we are working much more on this element, how we make the system more, once we have all the monetary policy, on the fiscal policy, etc., this is not enough to insulate the economy. We need to make the economy, therefore we have to build much more buffer stocks.
That's right.
Both economically and socially. It means also the level of education, it means, you know, all the aspects that make a society resilient and resistant to change that we cannot predict.
I see, Nicola.
The element of unpredictability become really central in what we are doing here.
And dare I say, not just in emerging countries. Frank, don't you agree? We're facing shocks. We have the institutions. I mean, we follow the textbook when it comes to the build-up of institutions, but the shocks remain. As I said earlier on, the financial crisis started with a very small economic segment in the U.S. that spread in ways that were totally unknown. But also, now the threat of trade wars. We need to prepare not only with multiple complex models that allow for many dimensions, but prepare for things that they're very difficult to prepare for.
Yeah,
how do you go about that?
I mean, first, I guess two principles come to my mind. First one is do not harm. No.
That's right.
If you are a policymaker, then at least you should try not to cause trouble yourself. And of course, then the question is, okay, how do you do that? I mean, one is by actually having a clear, transparent mandate, because that actually helps anchor expectations and probably makes the system more robust by itself. But sort of the Hippocratic oath, I think, is one principle in this type of environment. Do not add to volatility. I mean, the second one, I think, has to do indeed with building more resilience sort of systems, economic systems. And to some extent, that's what one of the main lessons has been of the crisis, that is to build up buffers. I mean, buffers in the financial system, buffers not so much, but in the fiscal policy. Buffers even in monetary policy, when you think about the small positive inflation number. So that's one way of making the system more robust to shocks. I mean, having said that, I mean, in the end, as a policymaker, you have to make decisions, and they most of the decisions are forward-looking. No? Your actions.
That's right.
In the future, so we should be very much aware of the uncertainty there is around our forecasts. But I'm afraid we cannot forecast. I mean, what's important is not to put too much weight on your baseline, to put a lot of weight on the uncertainty, but more importantly, to try to think about alternative scenarios, alternative.
That's right. Yeah.
Stories. Try to think out of the box and see what it implies for you.
Okay. So then, what I take from you for today is that we need more models to be able to tell more stories and increase our understanding of the things we've missed prior to the crisis, and then build our buffers in order to allow us to think about the things that we don't know yet. Exciting times ahead, I agree, and it's a good time to be a macroeconomist, a lot to do. But I'm afraid this is all the time we have for today, and that brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening to the Director's Cut, and thanks very much to my guests, Nicola and Frank, for joining me from far afield. You can find more of Bruegel's blog posts and publications on our website at www.bruegel.org. I hope you'll join us again for The Sound of Economics. Until next time, goodbye.